I heard weird stories. One girl, you know, asking for a job, and he wanted her to work for her because he wanted her to work topless. And she refused, but then there was coming up this other girl from the edge of the supermarket, and she, yeah, okay, I'll do it, and just jumped in, and they went off, and I'm like, what the fuck?
Two symbols of late 1960s revolution and rebellion grapple with the changing times. The Humboldt County pot grower community in Netflix's six-part Murder Mountain, and the former weatherman in Oscar-nominated documentary The Weather Underground. Not sure bombs, joints, and naked carpentry is quite as catchy as sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but grab your tool belts and a lighter, and let's find out. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 83. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, True Crime in Review. Joining me for today's discussion is OG, that's original guest, not original grower, Toby Ball. Hello, Toby.
I always clean my weed topless.
I think I read that about you in the ladies' room. All right, let's get right into it with our most wanted section. Murder Mountain. Here is the case file, in case you're not familiar with this Netflix series, although it has been out a while. In Humboldt County, California, the big business of legal marijuana brings in visitors from around the world. Some are never seen again. That's a hell of a capsule summary from Murder Mountain's Netflix landing page, and it's a pretty good one of the series, specifically that it starts from the true crime point of the second part with the disappearance of Garrett Rodriguez, and it uses that as an entree to the first part, an account of the history and changing times of the country's biggest production area for marijuana. This series is from one of my favorite crime doc producers, Josh Zeman of Cropsey, Killer Legends, and others, and it dropped at the end of December. Toby, you already discussed it on Crime Writers On, but you wondered if we might take another run at it here on The Blotter Presents. Do you want to tell me why that is? Have you heard something in regards to my attitudes about marijuana that made me a likely discussion partner for this topic?
I think there's just so much stuff to talk about in this documentary, and you know, on Crime Writers we got to some of the stuff I thought was interesting about it, but then other things we didn't explore quite as much, so I thought, what better place than right here?
Yeah, you didn't feel the bowl was fully resonated.
No,
I hear you. Yes. No, I am not no longer a partaker of the wacky tobacco, but did take my to date only arrest for possession. Two whole counts. Woo.
Wow.
Yes. Talk about most wanted. That was me in Mercer County, New Jersey.
What year was this?
This was 1994.
Wow.
Yeah. My parents were horrified and kept offering to have it expunged, like on various birthdays. And I was like, I'm not trying to work for the FBI. Who cares? Anyway, but I am definitely sort of like pro legalization, and I'm excited to talk with you, especially since you were my guest for that prohibition episode of this podcast, about how criminalizing certain things makes criminals, but we will get to that later. First, I want to ask you how familiar you were with Zeman's past work. Had you seen anything that he'd done before? Had you watched Killer Legends or Cropsey?
You know, I hadn't. I'd watched the very beginning of Cropsey, and for whatever reason, didn't get very far into it, but I know that people really like him.
Yeah, I've really liked his work. He's like a friend of a friend, I think. And my friend and past guest, John Ramos, suggested back in the day that I seek out Cropsey because it's sort of this urban legend based in reality that is local. It's a Staten Island story. And it's a like bogeyman that we were all familiar with growing up in the tri-state area. And then Killer Legends, I went past on Netflix like 15 times. I was like, that looks like bullshit. I'm not watching it. But it was actually a feature from him about urban legends that are derived from actual crimes and killers. And it wound up being really good, despite a name that didn't really tell you anything and made it sound like some crappy History Channel thing that they just dumped at 2 a.m.
Right.
So I was planning to watch Murder Mountain anyway, and then when I found out it was Josh Zeman, I was super excited. And I tore through this in like a day and a half, even stopping to take notes. What did you think of it generally, Toby? Did you think it was solid? Did you think it should have been shorter? Did you think it should have been longer? What was your like general feeling after you got to the end?
So I really liked it. It sort of combined true crime with like another genre I really like, which is sort of documentaries about subcultures. Mm-hmm. So I think that was actually the stronger part of this, was the history and then sort of current state of this, you know, group of people, these growers in Humboldt County. And I thought that was all really interesting. And I thought the true crime part of it was pretty illuminating about that community. Some of the details I didn't think were quite as interesting as the other parts of the documentary, but I thought for the whole, I think both sides of it, the true crime and then the sort of history and culture part of it, really knitted together well to sort of form this larger portrait.
Yeah, I thought so too. At times, it felt there was this tendency at the beginning of each episode to like repeat and remix the beginning, what you heard at the end or in the previous episode, which I think I'm not sure what the history of this production was, because that's something that you would tend to see on commercial TV, whereas something that's made for streaming, they don't usually do that. It wasn't bothersome to me. It was just a little bit strange to see in a streaming property. But at times I felt like the crime part felt slower, and I felt like maybe this should have been longer, and they should have like front loaded the crime part and not been going back and forth between the two timelines, especially since those timelines aren't that far apart. But at the end, it worked for me. And I also appreciated that there was some amount of processy behind the scenes insight into, like you say, the subculture. In clip two, here's this guy, Austin. I think this is Austin, who is still on the black market side of things, because the money's better. And he's talking about his procedure. And I believe he's just been in the parking lot of a motel that's like a sort of pot, black market pot station, like way station. And he's talking about the procedure for packaging, which is why they use the motel in clip two.
We always put down a sheet right over where we're working. We don't want to leave any residue on the ground. The vacuum sealer, the vacuum bags, gloves, Clorox disinfecting wipes. So first thing we do is we dump the contents of the oven bag into the vacuum sealing bag, making sure that we don't spill any along the way. Place the bag inside the sealer. Make sure the bag doesn't collapse in on itself. That ensures that you don't crush the product. So double bag it. Afterwards, you use the disinfecting wipes to wipe down for any fingerprints and any other residue that may be on the bag. We're going to drive these about 10 miles south to the buyer. Would I rather do it legally? No. I don't think the legalization has had the effect that everybody expected it to. You know, it kind of takes the fun out of the whole thing.
Well, yeah, which sounds like sort of an obnoxious thing to say, but there's a line shortly after this about the fact that the real money was in the risk that was being assumed by growers and sort of everyone in the supply chain. And once the danger has been subtracted, then you're left with all the crappy parts of being an S corp, honestly. Like, you have to get a lawyer, you have to be incorporated. Like, I thought it was really interesting that, you know, that they just went into like, well, now this is a like Department of Health issue and it has to be inspected for pesticides, and there's a certain permissible level of like whatever it was that I was like, oh, that's so, and they check it for strength. And then they put a little seal on it. I was like, oh, I mean, of course they do that. That's the whole point of it. This is how alcohol is made also. That's perfectly logical. But I thought the way that all of that was sort of outlined and then underlined with stories from people on camera was really well done.
Right. I mean, I kind of reacted the way I did to that last bit, because soon after that, I think Austin gets jumped and like beat up and put in the hospital.
Yeah.
And then he gets out and finds out that his farm has been trashed by people who he ripped off, who are working for him. So that was probably seemed a little bit less fun for him. But yeah, I mean, I think that one of the sort of interesting sort of plot lines in all of this is that legalization, turns out to be, you know, hurtful for most of these farmers, in that there is, you know, it takes some of the, I guess, the pressure from law enforcement off them to an extent. But then instead of just it being illegal, it goes to being, you know, regulated, and then they have to sort of do the steps so that they are in compliance with the regulation. And that, in fact, those sort of strictures make it much, much more profitable to be a huge operation.
Right,
and so
yeah,
they're most likely just going to be run out. And it is kind of interesting in that it becomes, you know, as soon as it becomes legal, all these sort of capitalist forces come into play. And just like with every other kind of farmer in our country,
that's,
you know,
what
they
just
lose out
say
to big agriculture.
Yeah, exactly. That, like, unless you can do, like, this is not an agrarian society, and unless you're Monsanto, you know, your choices are be extremely, extremely artisanal, or be Del Monte, and there's like there's no in between, like there's no middle class anywhere, but certainly not in farming.
So yeah, the guy I liked, one of the guys I liked in this was a guy, was it the Humboldt Solution? Was that, what's the name of his,
No, it wasn't the
company.
Humboldt Solution. It was the Humboldt.
It was something like that.
Yeah, I can't remember, but there was like a son. I can't remember.
But he's got these like kind of groovy t-shirts that he's always wearing.
Yeah.
And
is that
so
Jason
Dookie? That sounds right.
I think this was the, proprietor who went to like a big meeting to get to see if his interim like license had been approved.
Right.
All dressed up in like gnarly cargo shorts, shower shoes.
Right. That's a different guy.
Oh, okay.
That was the guy who totally screwed those workers, because they let his plants get moldy.
Yeah.
This is the guy who was wearing those t-shirts, like heavily branded t-shirts with like these really psychedelic designs. And he's actually the guy who owns the farm that the cops go to towards the end.
Right.
Where they think they're out of compliance. But, you know, the guy does so much like marketing, like wearing his t-shirts on the documentary, and they're kind of cool. And I actually went and checked out their website, and they're like, due to like much higher than expected demand, you know, it's going to be months before we get these t-shirts out. I was like, all right, so this guy,
it's like,
this
maybe
guy,
if you weren't
this guy's
ripping
got a fighting chance.
Eight bong hits a day, I mean, I know this is your job and you can call this quality control. And also, I don't know, like you seem to be a functional adult who has charge of children. Like he didn't seem impaired by it, but dang.
Yeah, they're making jam or something, artisanal jams.
Well, yeah, he was really smart about it, that it's like in this sort of financial climate for this industry, you need to really be leaning on all the ancillary, what was it he called it, a bud and breakfast?
Yeah.
I was like, that's terrible. Good for you. Yeah. I would laugh at that and be like, fuck off, that pun is horrible. And then I would totally go there and buy a t-shirt.
Right. But can you imagine like showing up for like your nice weekend away and that guy's like hanging out, like serving you eggs, yelling at his workers, telling them to get out of there.
I mean, I don't know. Like I worked with my brother at a music rehearsal space for enough time that like that guy is half the clientele, and you know, I don't know. I guess I'm used to that. But he sort of was like the new breed of grower that embraces that he's going to have to go legit and there's going to be smaller margins and he's going to have to figure out how to turn it into like a lifestyle brand and not just part of the back to the land movement. But one of the things I thought the series did well was compare those two sets of attitudes. It's sort of like the idealism of the first batch of OGs that came in the 60s with who's trying to make a living at it now, without really putting them into a false conflict. I thought that was good.
Yeah. I there's so much interesting stuff in it, I think. And then there's like the new generation, but then there's also like the new generation that's the kids of the old generation, and how those two pieces kind of interact a little bit.
Well, and I was also seeing what I felt were a number of couples where there was not like a unsettling or, you know, negative, not in a negative way, but that there was a woman who was probably 15 or 20 years younger than her partner, who had already like been up here doing this, and she and her white girl dreads came in as a trimmigrant and stayed. And now they have, you know, they have a bunch of kids, probably all named after Bob Dylan songs. I mean, I shouldn't be rude, but it did seem like there were a couple of people in talking heads that it was like, you know, you were a trimmigrant and you stayed. And the one woman with the sort of peach hair, I think she was pretty open about the fact that that's what happened, but, and there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's interesting to see how it sort of, how outsiders come in and then become part of this insular community. Although I think a lot of people come up there with grand ideas of racking up a few thousand bucks and smoking a lot of buds, and it's not quite what they thought it was going to be. Here is clip 3.
Kids come up here sometimes thinking this is one big reggae festival.
They feel like they're going to come to paradise, that they're going to make a ton of money, they're going to be smoking weed, living the good life up in the forest, up in the mountains. And when they get there, a lot of times they end up in various dangerous situations.
And a lot of times bad things happen, and a lot of times it's not even close to what they think this little Shangri-La trip of theirs is what they thought it was going to be.
One of the things that I wished the series had explored a little more is there was a sequence at the Greyhound bus station, and I think local sheriff talking about how people get off the Greyhound bus and are expecting to sort of just follow someone into the woods and get a job, you know, trimming.
Right.
And then like make a bunch of money, and then they're getting preyed on by people who know that's what they're there for. And people are ending up like sex trafficked, like rolled and left in the woods. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about what the, how often that happens, and if anyone survives these interactions. Law enforcement seemed to be well aware of it and was kind of trying to keep an eye on it, but that did seem
to an extent.
Yeah, but that seemed like something that came up and then was dropped.
So that was a big question I had, was it seems like for whatever reason, Garrett's murder had a much larger consequence than what at least they make you think is happening like fairly frequently with people disappearing or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, why was it this particular one that suddenly got everybody up in arms?
Yeah. And it wasn't just his family. It was the locals who sort of like decided to plant a flag on this kid's murder and this kid's disappearance, that they're like, this isn't what our community is about. And we're like, we're going to get the alleged perpetrator to tell it. Oh my God, that was insane. That they just kept being like the alleged. After
yeah,
a while.
That was driving me insane.
Yeah. Like you can't just beep it out. Like literally everybody who's involved knows.
Right.
Who you mean. Can't you just fix that in post? I guess their legal team told them no. But yeah, that was interesting. And this is something that I think they finally decided in what, 2016 or 2017? The Alder Point 8? Or was that closer to Garrett's disappearance?
I'm not going to remember that.
Yeah, I don't either. And I just watched this a few days ago. But that, you know, that is sort of, I wish I remembered where that was in the timeline, because I think it says something a little different if it's more recent, that, you know, these locals who view themselves as kind of the town elders decide that this won't stand. And then there's like this cascade effect of killings after that, and have, you know, what's been the aftermath in terms of people reporting disappearances, people cooperating with law enforcement? What did that do in either direction? And that may not have been followed up.
Right.
As much as
I couldn't
even
tell, like, were those guys like really elders for like the mountain or the town, or were they just like the guys who are on that road? You know, that was one thing that I had a little. And it's not really, I guess, the fault of the documentary. It might just be some ridiculous question I have in my own mind that they didn't have to answer. But how do, like, sort of geographically or socially or whatever, how do those that group of families on that road, how do they relate to, like, that Dookie guy or the guy who
right.
owns the
– Yeah, that's a good point.
I couldn't tell if like they would all go and talk to that one guy who is supposedly like sort of the father figure and stuff, or whether that was just like literally like this little neighborhood. And then there are these other sort of, you know, social arrangements in other places on the mountain or in the town, because there's not, you know, there doesn't seem to be like a real functional government.
Well, yeah, that's, I could have used, I think, a better geographic sense of what these towns were in relation to each other and in relation to themselves, because I think Eureka is a very different community from Alder Point, is a very different community from, you know, like there's a Humboldt County. I have no sense of like how just physically big it is. And having just read that Lawrence Wright book about, you know, God Save Texas, and that there are counties that are like bigger than whole states.
Right.
And, you know, where I'm from, a county is like, I don't know, 6 to 8 towns. You could probably walk from end to end in a, you know, in a day. And in Texas, it's like they're crossing whole time zones and you might not see anyone that's not a cow for 2 days. And so that my sense of how big Humboldt County is and how sometimes it was, you know, spoken of as this not monolithic culture, but I think there are a lot of variations within it that in the case of Garrett Rodriguez's disappearance and then the sort of vengeance that was attempted by the locals, it would have been helpful to have more specifics in that regard. Certainly they were not afraid to get specific about how times have changed since the 60s. I don't know if I'm glad or not that we don't have an accompanying visual for this clip, but it just sort of made me smile. This guy narrating him and his fellow communards wearing nothing but work boots and tool belts. And I mean nothing. Clip 4.
Naked with the exception of our tools.
Why were you guys naked?
Why were we naked? Because it's hard to answer your question why we were naked. First of all, it is our natural state after all. Secondly, this was the quintessential hippie life. Unfettered, with a quality and quantity of freedom not experienced by a lot of people.
A lot of people came up here just to get away from the materialism and the dishonest values that grip our culture and which are continuing to be the great disease of our times.
I mean, really, that flute?
I know.
Says it all.
It was groovy.
It was deeply groovy. This is an area that I could have sort of sat with for much longer. I would have loved a very painstaking history of the county, like just in the 60s and 70s. I would have been interested in what that was like and how people were schooled and whether people tended to stay.
Yeah, I think that's all. Like, I would read a book about that, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, even like in the 80s in college, you know, Humboldt County had a, you know, there was definitely kind of a legend around it, you know, when people talked about Humboldt County, and it was like sort of hippies, but also sort of hard ass hippies. And, you know, this is where the Grateful Dead would like hang out. And,
right.
You know, there was always that aspect to them, right? Where the Dead were like the hippie band, but there's also sort of a side to them that seemed a little darker, especially with like some of the hangers on and like the roadies and their sort of relations with the Hell's Angels and stuff. So that, I think it's like a lot of California. I think the history of it's super interesting. And, you know, I also just kind of the story of, so I guess they have like two people who had sort of been there since the beginning, and they tell that story about how, you know, basically marijuana was just like one of their staples. And yeah, it wasn't until they went and they smuggled those seeds out of Afghanistan that they're like, oh shit, we can make money off this.
Right.
But that seems like that was like opening Pandora's box, you know, because suddenly that just changed the relationship completely. They went from being like subsistence farmers to like growing a cash crop that, you know, for whatever reason, the government decided was illegal. And that led to the whole thing, right? It led to sort of the societal values of keeping to yourself, and you've got your own plot and you're anti-government, and, you know, you're reliant on yourself for protection. And so this whole thing kind of grew out of, you know, this weird like from stage one to stage two of capitalism, and then the added fact that what they were growing and trying to sell is illegal, and then you end up with this totally messed up little society. And you know, I guess people can have their opinions about how well it works, but you know, it doesn't seem like it's a model for anything.
Right. Well, and I just kept thinking back to like Depression era Appalachia, and that you're also dealing with subsistence farmers who, like, the terrain is unforgiving, but that's what allows them to sort of melt into it when the law comes to town. And, you know, which is the cause of this production of moonshine, and which is the effect. And, you know, there's all this leftover grain. And I mean, I don't know anything about that from a like societal or market evolution standpoint, but I'm fascinated by any culture that sort of it has removed itself from what it sees as the dominant culture, but and then just like melted into or like disappeared physically into the land. I just think is cool. I'm so citified at this point that I find that sort of fascinating. And then you also have a number of people that like came home from the war and were like, I'm just going to walk in among the redwoods and find a place where I don't have to talk to people for weeks at a time.
Right.
And that, of course, is one of the Virgils on our journey, John Riley, who ends up like kind of being the only man left standing who heard the alleged say where Garrett's body was and knew what had happened. And he's such an interesting figure because he has a certain way of putting things that is reluctant. So it has a poetry to it, and he doesn't really want anything to do with society, and yet he is this translator of sorts in the documentary. Let me play a clip from him talking about the discovery of Garrett's body, and then I wanted to ask what you thought of a certain closure moment towards the end. Here's clip five.
There's a certain pallor that takes over the atmosphere in the presence of death. You seem to walk slower, think slower, talk slower. Everything slows down. It was a shallow grave. It didn't take a long time. I came up with remains of Garrett. Although I thought I was ready for it, it was a difficult task.
There's just something about his relating of not just this, but various other circumstances that is like almost mid-century, like not Hemingway-esque, but the terseness is very poetic. And the fact that I think all things considered, he would prefer to just be on a back porch somewhere whittling, but he feels that this is testimony that he is obligated as a human being to provide. It's really something. I enjoyed getting to know him.
Yeah, I mean, he seems like, you know, sort of a sensitive soul, and you know, I feel like I got a sense of why, you know, I think Vietnam was traumatizing to anybody who was over there, but why he would sort of need to sort of profoundly retreat.
Yes.
And then it was also interesting to see his son, you know, who, you know, he hasn't kind of taken the way of his father. I mean, he's sort of assimilated into the culture on that road or that group or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, rides with the vigilantes, basically.
Yeah, that late breaking development, I don't think it was forced or anything. I think it was organic to the story, because I don't think the production had heard that he was present until Riley Sr. like mentioned it.
Right.
In passing.
No. Yeah, that seemed totally natural, as opposed to what I think you're about to talk about.
Yeah, but I was going to ask what you thought of the like summit meeting between Garrett's father and John Riley.
I can understand why the filmmaker would want to do it. And I could see why some people would like it. To me, it just seemed like, of all the things that went on in this, you know, 6-part series, that to me seemed like sort of the falsest note, in that it seemed like it was kind of staged for the camera.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't kind of staged for the camera. It was staged for the camera, and maybe those guys would have gotten together anyway, but the way they did and the way it kind of went seemed completely contrived to me.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not convinced that it was the first time they had met. Like, it seemed
that could be true.
So staged. It did seem like, if this story has been unfolding for the better part of 5 years, I mean, unless Val? What is Garrett's father's name? Buzz?
I think that's right.
Val?
Yeah. Oh, God.
I think it's both. I think his name is Val.
And yeah, I think it's like Val, Buzz. Quote Buzz.
All right, why don't I just call him Garrett Sr.? That's easier.
Yeah.
I think that Garrett Sr. absolutely would have reached out, but I guess it's not entirely clear that he knew by name who was present and who was part of this mission to get the alleged to tell them where Garrett's body was. But it just seemed like, if you wanted to reach out to this guy, why would you have waited to do this when this is all a couple of years in the rear view? So yeah, I didn't care for that. And I really sort of felt for John Riley, like, having to do this somewhat, I don't know, like, it's like the reunions on Unsolved Mysteries that they used to do between, like, long lost, like, separated adopted sets of twins or whatever. It's like, well, you know, like, oh, what could be happening? Like, well, there's a camera in your living room, so you know something's going on. Like, come on. Help you.
Yeah, well, so what's interesting is that the sentence, was that what it was called? That one that we watched before, where it was so that was like the opposite, where that those scenes seemed completely genuine because the guy who's actually doing the filming is always filming anyway and is part of the family.
Yes.
So that that's such a part of their sort of natural circumstance that when stuff happens, it's like, oh, you know, that makes sense to me. Whereas this thing, like, two guys like sitting in the back of a pickup truck talking about, you know, one guy's dead son, it's like, you know, I just don't, like, why would it be this way?
Well,
like,
if
it
was like me,
why don't you meet at like a coffee shop or go to the guy's house or something? It was just the whole thing was odd.
And then the presentation of the fishing poles.
Yeah.
I was like, I mean, even if those aren't evidence, the timing of this is bizarre to me. And I actually do, like, I would watch like a follow-up documentary about like them going on fishing trips together and just like not talking, directed by Werner Herzog. But like, it just, I felt like it sold them both out, because I think there is probably a genuine relationship there. And I think Zeman maybe sold himself out a little bit doing that. I don't know.
I think it seemed like such a too good an opportunity as a filmmaker probably to let go. But
yeah,
the two things that I thought were poorly judged were that, and I think it just started way, way, way too slow.
Yeah.
I had on like Twitter and Facebook, there are a lot of people who are like, this is so boring, I'm out. And I've only watched half an hour, but I'm so bored, I'm out. I'm like, just stick with it to the first episode. If you don't find the end of the first episode to be intriguing, then give up on it. But it takes a long time to get going. And a lot of it's just because they're and it's weird too. It seems a little bit off because they're trying to put Garrett so much in the center of everything.
Yeah.
Like that's going to be really what this is about. And, you know, it is somewhat about him, but what, maybe a third in all, you know, there's just so much other stuff going on.
Well, and it also seems somewhat reluctant to investigate what exactly happened to him before he got killed, perhaps because
that's true.
He got his own fool ass killed. And I want to be clear. I like what happened to him should not have happened. I am not trying to victim blame, but it just seemed sometimes like there was something that we weren't being told for fear that we would judge him. But then at the same time, they were trying to tell us with stuff like that clip I played before. It's like kids come up here and they think it's going to be easy money and they're going to get baked, and then it's hard work or they get into some kind of altercation and it's dangerous. And it's like, what exactly are you trying to tell us, if anything, about Garrett?
Right.
Because I don't know, like I work here. I know there's no such thing as a perfect victim and that's not necessary. But
yeah. And he's working for this guy who everybody thinks is a psycho.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, everybody's, like, he was working for him and everybody thinks he's like a bad actor.
Right. And then everyone is sufficiently, like, everybody basically knows what went down, but nobody really does anything about it for however long, presumably because they're fucking scared of this guy with reason, it sounds like.
Right.
So, yeah. I didn't really notice that it started that slow. I mean, I don't know.
I kind of felt like it did, but I sort of, you know, I was so intrigued by the rest of it that I kind of forgot about that. But I did think, you know, there is quite a bit of, you know, the father talking wistfully about his son's dreams and how he bought a place down in Mexico and his son was going to inherit it and how he told him so many times, don't go up there. And they, you know.
Well, and you do start to see, you know, pretty early on, some repeats of the same pictures of Garrett with future seafood. Then it's like, okay, we got it. He was a good time guy who liked to fish. But yeah, generally speaking, I thought it was well paced and pretty efficient in making its points about prohibition and what happens when you make marijuana criminal. Then you're creating criminals, and then in turn, what happens when you try to decriminalize it and the unintended consequences of that. I thought they did a good job illustrating that without being too heavy-handed. So that was good. I'm going to actually skip ahead to our last clip of this section because I thought it was, I thought it sort of summed up how efficiently Murder Mountain made this point.
After 20 years of law enforcement attempting to wipe everybody out, it's really ironic that legalization is able to potentially destroy what criminalization couldn't.
Well, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, overall, I thought this was good. It did raise some questions in my mind, but that's not a bad thing. I didn't have a problem with the pace of it in the beginning. I did wonder at times if this shouldn't have been two separate features, one about the disappearance of Garrett Rodriguez and one about the history of Humboldt County. But the fact that it mushed the two together, you know, I think it was good. But on the other hand, I'm a big Zeman fan and I may have a higher tolerance than some for his, he has a way of like zigging sometimes into another idea in the middle of a project and then not zagging back to center, which I'd sort of enjoy and don't mind. But your mileage may vary on that. But yeah, I thought it was good. And thank you for making me watch it in a timely fashion.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. It's one of the few things that I think I might watch again sometime. I just thought it was that interesting. And I feel like there was probably some stuff, some good stuff that didn't register the first time through.
Yeah, I might watch it again too. And I will recommend that you check out Killer Legends. If you sort of tried Cropsey and didn't like it, no need to go back.
I think I started watching it and then like, I don't know, like I got a phone call or something. I just never picked it back up again. Right. You know, it was one of those. I wasn't like so intrigued that I had to get back to it, but it wasn't that I turned it off in disgust or anything like that.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, it's just a feature. So lower time commitment.
That's true.
All right. On to your second suggestion then in our cold case section. You brought us the 2003, I believe, documentary called The Weather Underground. Here's the case file. The Weather Underground, or Weathermen, were a radical left-wing domestic terror group that aimed to overthrow U.S. imperialism. Formed as a faction of the SDS in the late 60s in response to the war in Vietnam, the Weathermen organized riots, bombed banks and public buildings, and issued myriad communiques on capitalist piggery, the persecution of the Black Panthers et al., that somehow managed to be real eye rollers and still relevant today. Green and Siegel's 2003 documentary lost the Academy Award to The Fog of War, go figure, but certainly I found it a worthy companion piece to material on Patty Hearst and 70s skyjackings that I've been contemplating lately on this year podcast as a reflection of a deeply disorienting time, much like our own. What made you want to discuss this one? Had you watched this before?
No, I'd watched a different documentary about the Weather Underground and thought it was interesting and I couldn't find that somehow. So I suggested this. I just find like, I think sort of thematically there's some connection to Murder Mountain.
Oh, for sure.
But then, you know, I've always thought that this era of sort of radical left revolutionaries, and that includes like Bader Meinhof in Germany and Red Brigade in Italy. I just find it really interesting. So it seemed like that would be, I was interested to watch it. I was hoping you would be too.
I liked it. It can look a little cheap sometimes in a way that I wasn't expecting, like especially the present day interviews seem like they were shot in like just crappy.
It's like cable video. Access.
Yes, it did look like cable access. But the narrator is Pamela Z, and then Lily Taylor is reading some of the.
Oh, is that who that was? Yeah,
I was like, oh, of course, that totally makes sense. And then the soundtrack, you may hear it in some of the clips that I'm going to play. There's this just like weird kind of like ear ringing cue that is very disorienting and I think is effective at like paralleling the crazy times that this was all unfolding during. But I also liked that some of the former weathermen were talking about what being underground means in a practical sense and how actually pattern recognition does the work for you. This is from fairly late in the documentary, but here's clip 8.
When weather first went underground in 70, the conventional wisdom that we would be rounded up within a year. You don't remember the 50s. I grew up in the 50s. Every TV program, the police or the FBI always got their man. In fact, I think there was a movie code. You couldn't show people getting away with crime. So there was a psych in the population that it was impossible to defy the FBI. Everybody on the left said, no, this is only going to last for a few months.
Underground is sort of a state of information control rather than a place. It means having a lot of control about who knows what, about who you are and where you are. So you don't have a phone in the house. All phone calls are made from phone booths. I didn't hang out in places where a lot of people from my past were going to recognize me.
It's a parallel universe. I mean, the number of times that I would run into people who should have recognized me and didn't was astronomical. Because how would they recognize you? You were underground. So you couldn't possibly be walking out of that theater because you're not here. You're invisible.
I just thought that was cool. Like, I am more interested in the underground part. And they're talking about how, you know... Wonder Twins assemble or whatever, like that when it was time to meet the people from like the headquarters, I guess, would sort of tell them where to meet and they would meet at a coffee shop. And then one woman talks about how she had some strong words for how things were being done and how things were being run. And she was never contacted for a meet again. And she's like, well, I guess I'm out of the weathermen. I just thought that was so funny that it's like,
right.
Well, we're just never going to call her again. So she can be underground if she wants, but she's out. It was just weird. But I thought that was cool.
Yeah. And it seems like such a, like a thing of the past too. Like I guess I don't really know like who would be underground these days, but it does seem like when somebody's really being looked for, they're almost always like, you know, go into the woods, like go Sasquatch, like the guy in Murder Mountain said, is, you know, it's like Eric Rudolph was one of those guys. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's so much possibility for surveillance these days that I think it's harder to live like those guys did because, like, well, you don't have a phone. Like, I don't know how effective that is these days.
Well, and there's also the fact that the discovery of all those files persecuting Dr.
Right,
King, the Black Panthers, and that all of that stuff was illegal. And
COINTELPRO.
Right. And it would have ruined the case against not just the weathermen, but numerous other protesters and, you know, so-called revolutionaries, that it kind of takes the wind out of your sails. Like, a lot of people did turn themselves in and the FBI's like, all right, don't do it again. You're free to leave. And they're like,
yeah,
but, you know, power to the people. And they're like, right, we heard you. Get a job.
All right, take it easy.
Yeah.
Work on that resume.
Yeah, that was, I felt really bad. There's this one, I think it was Bernadine Dorn, who was like, I refused on principle to turn myself in because that's just not something I'm going to do. And then they're like, just do it. Like, I think she and Bill Ayers had a kid by then. And she was like, fine, I'll turn myself in. And kind of was,
yeah, I think they had two, and one of them was getting like school age, and she's like, this is gonna get super awkward. Yeah. Like, I don't know how this is gonna all work once he has to start going to school.
Yeah, so she sort of made a big show of like, fine, I'll turn myself in. And they're like,
right, but I'm still for the revolution. And she gets on the elevator.
Yeah.
And then that one guy's in prison, though, like, they never really explained like why he's like, of all the people, like, he's the one guy.
Because he robbed a Brinks truck and a couple of people.
Oh, is that
killed.
What it was?
Yeah,
I must have missed that part.
Yeah, I thought it was. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, this is something that is associated with this group, but this documentary chose not to, sort of chose to end at 1980, and then the Brinks robbery was, I think, 1981, and that's okay. Why that guy's in jail is because he killed people. So. Yeah, like it wasn't all fun and games and accidentally blowing up James Merrill's family townhouse in the village.
Right. Well, I thought what they did really good job at the beginning was sort of establishing like how violent things were.
Yeah, just like the world
in America and violence that America was bringing other places, and then the way, you know, sort of leftist movements in different countries were being violent.
Yeah.
And because I think without that context, like what they're doing seems even more kind of crazy.
Yeah. I mean, they open with the clip that I'm about to play, which is a communique that is, like I said before, like it's kind of an eye roller. But at the same time, the film does a great job sort of immediately contextualizing this in the desperation that people on the left genuinely felt about trying to move the ball in terms of stopping the war, stopping the persecution and harassment of people of color, and just that, you know, peaceful protest and voting was not getting it done. So they all start wearing berets and issuing communiques, which seems ridiculous to us now, but I think they just felt desperate and they had to do something. But at the same time, oh, hippies, here's clip 9.
Hello, I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weatherman Underground. Kids know the lines are drawn. Revolution is touching all of our lives. Freaks are revolutionaries, and revolutionaries are freaks. If you want to find us, this is where we are. In every tribe, commune, dormitory, farmhouse, barracks, and townhouse, where kids are making love, smoking dope, and loading guns, fugitives from American justice are free to go. Within the next 14 days, we will attack a symbol or institution of American injustice.
So you hear that soundtrack cue that I was talking about, where you feel like your ears have stuffed up, that you're like, am I hearing this correctly? And I thought that was an excellent use of not found footage, but just contemporary materials to illustrate like just the sort of painful sincerity of this time and this movement, and how perhaps certain, like, they didn't necessarily play it out all the way logically.
Yeah, it's just, and I, this whole thing about like the revolution, like where people are smoking dope, like making love and loading guns, just seems to me like such an odd, like, if you're really serious about like these things that you're going after, like, that just seems, you know, you're playing into, and maybe at the time it wasn't a stereotype, but it's just like, is that really the most considered, like, effective way to kind of make the case that you want sort of fundamental change in society? Are those three things? Like, we're oversexed, we're on drugs, and we have guns. It's a little weird. Like, I could see, like, there is this sense, and I think they do a good job in the documentary where the Black Panthers are, for the most part, like, what the fuck?
Oh, you know, yeah. Like, I was considering cutting a clip of that, but they're like, these people are fucking clowns. No thanks.
Right. It's like we're trying to do something serious, and it's really, you know, we're the people who are under assault by the police, and we have like sort of more of an agenda, you know, whether people agree with it or not, but we're not a bunch of, you know, fairly wealthy white kids, you know, who are suffering some kind of white guilt or, you know, whatever, and are trying to be revolutionaries from a position of privilege, which, you know, I guess in some ways is, you know, commendable that they're able to look beyond their own experiences. But for, you know, I think like Fred Hampton and Huey Newton and guys like that, it's just like, what are you doing? Yeah. Like, this is, you're sort of flailing. Instead of like actually this is making a social change.
Yeah, like this is a pretty theoretical pain for you.
Right.
Whereas for us, like we're actually dying out here daily because these changes aren't happening. And there's a level of naivete that in the clip we're about to hear, I forget which weatherman this is, but and there are a couple of them who are like, they you know, sort of reminisce about like, this was just kind of an excuse to talk a bunch of shit you learned in philosophy class and then have an orgy. A couple of them are really not fans of their own youthful work. But even this guy, who I think is still kind of a believer, sounds somewhat chagrined at their failure to account for human nature and capitalist institutions' power in clip 10.
Toward the end of 1968, I had really decided that I was committed to being a part of what I thought was going to be a really serious and ongoing rebellion, upheaval that had the potential of not just ending the war, but of really overthrowing the capitalist system and put in its place something much more humane.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like, my patience for some of this is limited, but I always have to try to put myself... Like, I think this just was much newer and more promising back then. And they weren't necessarily, they didn't necessarily have reason to be as cynical as we do now. So I try not to be too eye-rolly about it. But on the other hand, come on, man.
So the thing I find, like, I don't find the Weather Underground particularly attractive. What I do like.
Phew.
Sort of like is that, you know, this idea that to sort of question like sort of basic things about society that you don't find to be fair or equitable, which I don't think there's any, like, I think you have like Black Lives Matter to a certain extent and some stuff like that, but I don't think there's anybody who's really out there like critiquing capitalism as, you know, the basically the basis of our country and right. What does that mean? You know, so I do think like the only thing that I think is sort of interesting about them, and it's certainly not, they're not the only people who did it or even most effectively did it, but this idea that you would put everything on the table and say, look, is this really the way we want our society to work? And I think that's just, we're so far gone from that where, you know, there's certain things that we've just kind of agreed upon and there's nobody who's thinking, you know, is capitalism, like regulated capitalism, is that really the best way for us to run the economy of our country? That being said, you know, I just don't know. I mean, and maybe some of it is the 60s are part of the evidence there, but I don't think you can point to any sort of violent movement in American history that has achieved any of its societal goals. I mean, they always get turned back. So it's just, the idea that you're going to bomb some places and that that's going to like lead to a revolution is just so like far off the charts.
Well, and like, you also have to wonder, yeah, I mean, it's naive, but it's also like, well, let me play this clip and then we can talk about their conscientiousness in target selection.
We were very careful from the moment of the townhouse on to be sure we weren't going to hurt anybody. And we never did hurt anybody. Whenever we put a bomb in a public space, we had figured out all kinds of ways to put checks and balances on the thing and also to get people away from it. And we were remarkably successful.
Our goal was to not hurt any people, and a lot of work went into that. But we wanted to pick targets that show to the public who was responsible for what was really going on.
On the one hand, and, you know, I think they bombed the Capitol, right? They bombed the Capitol building. Would bomb banks, and there was, you know, the Days of Rage. That was a very funny segment to me because they're like, well, we don't have a lot of people here, but we're committed now. So I guess we're going to run at Chicago PD and
bust some windows.
Yeah, bust some windows at whatever dime bank. But on the one hand, I think that that's like if you're against capitalism and you're selecting seats of power in capitalism and causing destruction of property to make the point that, you know, our things own us and not the other way around, if that's your point, whatever, great. And if nobody is getting hurt, okay, the Brinks robbery did not go well. Village townhouse, I don't know, maybe get someone who knows electronics to build your bombs instead of smoking a bunch of pot and leaving dynamite around in the kitchen. But for the most part, that was their object and they stuck with that. On the other hand, if you're going to be that polite about your revolutionary aims and be like, you know, we have placed the bomb in the following place, please let us know when everyone's out and then we'll detonate it. I mean, not that they were doing that, but basically, like, please RSVP to this explosion. Like, I just don't know if that's going to be as fearsome a prospect in the halls of power as you might hope in order to shift things in a more socialist direction. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I just don't,
like, if you're gonna fuck shit up, fuck it up.
Yeah, I just, you know,
and if you're not,
I think there's a few things going on. One is I think that kind of kept them from being hunted down faster.
Oh, sure.
You know, right? And I think the fact that they were wealthy white kids, you know, that the government was a lot less effective in dealing with them than they were with the Black Panthers or the American Indian movement or non-white sort of wealthy kids. And then in the end, it's like, what did they accomplish? Like, you know, compared to what, you know, other groups, like even if you're comparing them to other groups of like wealthy white kids, you know, like Freedom Riders going down, registering voters, like accomplished something. You know, it seemed to me that they accomplished nothing very positive, in that, in fact, I think conservatives have dined out on this sort of idea of, you know, violent, destructive hippie leftists for decades.
While also, you know, capitalizing, if you'll excuse the use of that term, on the, like, the left eats itself.
Yeah.
Paradigm that this, you know, depending on your interpretation, that this may kind of epitomize.
So I, you know, in some ways, like, I think the diagnosis isn't bad. Like, I, you know, Vietnam War, the treatment of African Americans, the sort of problems with capitalism in our country, like all those things, I think are, you know, worthy subjects and worthy things to oppose. In most cases, capitalism, I think, is a little fuzzier than the other two, but the idea that, like, A, first through violence, but then B, through like violence where nobody gets hurt.
right.
Like, that's going to be the way that you're going to affect a change in all this stuff. Just, you know, and I think they kind of acknowledge it, is that it seems like, looking back on it, I mean, it seems crazy. And I think maybe that was sort of part of the scene setting at the beginning, is that, you know, for as, you know, disorienting and sort of troubling as the times we are in right now can seem, like, they're not super violent, like, in the way that those were. I mean, there's not, people aren't fighting the police, you know, outside political conventions, and we're not, like, drafting kids and going and fighting this, like, hot war overseas. I mean, there is violence, but it's at a different level. So that maybe things seemed more possible back then, but at least, you know, with hindsight, it seems like spending a little time thinking it through, you would have come up with the idea that this, you know, it seems unlikely that this is going to lead to, like, the working class rising up and overthrowing the capitalist oppressors and, you know, joining hands with, you know, our black brothers and sisters and, you know, stopping the war in Vietnam. It's just, it seems crazy.
Yeah. Well, and certainly many of their working class brothers and sisters having already been drafted.
Right. Or being politically, like, completely opposed to what they're after. I mean, they're not spouting a majority line here. It's not like they're taking the silent majority and having them rise up. I mean, their views are not popular in America at large.
Yeah.
So again, I find these groups really interesting because I have some sympathy for what they see, but then what they do seems to be like the absolute wrong way of going about it. Although, in all honesty, it's like, what is the right way of accomplishing those things that they really want to do? At that time, you know, it probably did seem like, with, you know, MLK Jr. being assassinated and the war continuing despite peaceful protests, blah, blah, blah. I mean, maybe you get to the point where it's like, well, the only thing that's going to do anything is violence, even though that may not do anything either. That's what hasn't been tried.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
And the Weather Underground does a good job, I think, implying that they felt like they had no choice, and sometimes getting them to say in so many words that this seemed like the only option. And it also, it does a good job presenting both the admirable fire and drive that these people had to try to make a change, which seemed to be, you know, not just being 19 and, you know, what are you rebelling against? What do you got? Bullshit. But I mean, that seemed to be genuinely motivated. But it also, it isn't afraid to stand back a little bit from them, even when they're participating in the documentary, and just kind of letting the futility, perhaps, and occasional absurdity breathe a little bit. So, yeah, it was a good hour and a half. It made me think about you know, cynicism in political action, and wasn't necessarily a cheery feeling, but yeah, it's good. No. It's good. I actually liked this. I liked The Fog of War fine. The documentary category is so weird.
Right.
Anyway, and I have a number of strong destruction of property objections to the current slate of nominees as we're recording this, but I thought this was better than The Fog of War. So
I feel like the fog of war, like, spoke to the generation, like, before us.
Yeah.
Probably yeah. more might have been part of it. I mean, I thought the fog of war was really interesting, but, you know, Robert McNamara is not, like, that name doesn't evoke the same visceral reaction in me than it would in, like, my parents. So. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, it's good. I want to get my son to watch the Weather Underground thing because I think, you know, he sometimes, you know, feels sort of, you know, a sense of hopelessness about how screwed up our country seems right now.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, things have actually been worse, like within my lifetime. Yeah, I thought it was really good. Again, I mean, it's sort of in my area of interest, but I would definitely recommend it.
Yeah, me too. And I think that many documentaries about these kinds of movements in the late 60s are, if not instructive, there are interesting parallels that are created with the present day and those feelings of hopelessness that I think we all feel at times in this country. And, you know, where do you start? Robbing a Brinks truck, but what do I know? Toby, where else can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at TobyBallNH. They can find me weekly on Mondays on the Crime Writers On podcast and at the Crime Writers On Patreon site. I am the host of Ball's Deep Dive Book Club, which is like a true crime book club. And I think actually today just dropped the most recent episode, which is about Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington's The Cadaver King and The Country Dentist, which is about the absolutely nuts and corrupt Mississippi death investigation system in the 80s and 90s.
Wow. Okay. That sounds great. And I think Alex Segura and I are returning to the deep dive folds yes. with Fatal Vision pretty soon. Yes.
Yes. It's like, I think there's nothing in January. February is The Real Lolita by Sarah Weinman and then also, Fatal Vision.
Also, is in March. Also on my list. Can't wait. All right. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming back for a record 178th time.
Yeah, I'm the Cal Ripken of this show.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Mark Blankenship contemplates a very British scandal. Kevin Smokler contemplates The Onion Fields, both book and movie. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can also email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. And you could become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, please leave a review on iTunes. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell a soul. My guest has been Toby Ball. He's on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.